So thank you all for joining us today so we could record this podcast together. So we have Terry Lynn from MD Anderson, Brianna from UPMC, and Ryan from UNC. And then I'm Andrew from MSK, and we're going to be talking about some updates to the ID guidelines from ASTCT that we've all had the opportunity to work on. So Terry Lynn, why don't you start with getting us into like how did you rope us into all this extra work that you sprung on everybody?
You're welcome for that.
Yeah,
I
absolutely.
guess first, just to give a little background, there is a nice publication, a preface for the series between the practice guidelines with the American Society of Transplant and Cellular Therapy, or ASTCT, as we all know, and the Infectious Disease SIG, with the ultimate goal to republish the Tomlin guidelines, right? Our sort of holy grail for infectious prophylaxis was last published in 2009. And because it was such a big scope and covered all infections and including vaccinations, it was very hard to update. So what they wanted to do was break it down into sections and sort of then be able to update in a more timely fashion than having to do it all at once. And so when they started this guideline tackle, they included pharmacy in some of the initial guidelines. And I think I really want to thank Dr. Chamali and Dr. Papanikolaou, who saw the value in including pharmacists in these guidelines and what we can bring to the table to make them all-encompassing. And so it was with building that relationship that of the 11 guidelines that are published so far, there is a pharmacist either as an author or acknowledged in 7 of the 11. With the intent to continue this formal collaboration as well. So we're looking forward to each year they're identifying and tackling new guidelines to have published. And so the 2 years ago now, or almost 2 years ago, we started working on the four guidelines that we are here to talk about.
Great. Actually, that brings me to the next question that I forgot to pre-populate. It's like, well, why don't we go around and say which ones we actually worked on so we know what we're talking about as we go through. Brianna and I worked on the CMV update to provide both an adult and pediatric perspective on this one, just because there was a bit more of an update on the ped side, but also we wanted to make sure we were getting everything all together.
And I think that's a really great point, Andrew, that there's already been a CMV update. So when you're looking at the series of the 11 guidelines, number 3 focused on CMV prophylaxis and number 4 focused on treatment, but those were published in 2021, right before we had a lot of changes that came in that landscape. So we already have an update. And I was part of the number 8 guideline, which was management and prevention of non-Aspergillus molds in transplant recipients. So this is the third iteration of some sort of fungal guideline or guidance that has been put out by the society.
And I got to work on series number 9, which was the management of HHV6B after hematopoietic cell and CAR T therapy. It was a great collaboration too, and I will get into a little more, but I can't thank Terry Lynn enough for, again, roping us into this. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I know we were all like happy to help, and I think it's only fitting that like ID physicians and then us as the BMT and cellular therapy pharmacists were roped in together because we're often talking directly to each other for our teams, and I think this is like really just highlights the collaboration that we have. The first question I want to ask everybody, so feel free to jump in whenever, is there a certain part of the guideline that you participated in this time that you would like to highlight for other pharmacists as a particular resource or point of interest that you would like to highlight?
So I think
Yeah.
for our, oh, go ahead, Ryan.
No, after you.
Yeah, for our CMV guideline, I know Andrew and I collaborated on updating one of the larger tables that was included in some of the initial guidelines. So adding some of the newer agents. So table 1 in our guideline, talking about all the agents for treatment or prevention, kind of gives a nice overview and is a reference point for all the agents, the dosing that they have, recommendations for metabolism and transport effects that we can see. So it kind of is a nice place to reference outside of just the content of the guidelines to kind of be one of those ones that you post up in your cubicle for reference as a pharmacist.
Yeah, totally. That was
And
the one I highlighted too for CMV. Sorry, Ryan, again.
oh,
But
you're fine.
I thought like the extra drugs were noteworthy to add. And then like table one in the old guideline, the older update was already like quite
Robust.
large and robust. Yeah. But adding the transport, I think, pathways and updating some of this the drug-drug interactions was helpful just because there are a lot of other things that I think only we see as the primary teams. Like we see patients that we have to manage who have a history of TB or other things like that, that and we need to think about those transports and metabolic effects as well.
Yeah, and I think what makes the most sense in the HHV6 guideline was the management of HHV6 is the portion that I hopped on to help edit. And I guess one question for the group or something I want to highlight is when you think of HHV6, like what is your go-to sort of drug that you typically use at each of your centers?
Foscarnet.
Yeah, we're foscarnet again.
Yeah.
Carnet.
And so I think a lot of people still lean foscarnet, and like when I trained over at the darker blue, it was the same. Where that's Duke for everybody who's not from North Carolina. Where if you see HHV6, immediately your brain goes to foscarnet. And I think one thing that I wanted to highlight, and what you see in the recommendations, is that ganciclovir is completely appropriate for HHV6B. The HHV6A does have some resistance to ganciclovir, but that's not what is pathogenic in humans. So, you know, what we see is ganciclovir sensitive. And so I think there are clinical data and in vitro data out there that support that. And so you can see both foscarnet and ganciclovir have the same recommendation and guidelines. So I think it's looking at pharmacists out there that might be newer to the FAQs and things, like that's one thing that I would highlight is you can use either, and it's really toxicity avoidance that you're trying to that helps you determine which agent to use. Yeah, so I think that was one big thing. Obviously, there's lots of other agents out there that probably are lower on my recommendation list that ha reflect that and the consensus recommendations there of like sidofovir and some of the combination regimens and things.
I would have to say, similar to Andrew and Bree, my focus on this particular guideline was the drug-drug interaction table, which we all know the
Yours is a bear.
triazoles. It is. I kept having to come up with new colors and symbols to figure out ways to highlight all the potential different interactions. So I tried to be all-encompassing of any literature that's available outside of just the general package insert or just, you know, clinical expertise and practice. And so I think it just really highlights the need for a pharmacist to be helping to manage these patients, both from a transplant and an infectious disease side of things, to really think about, you know, these medications are not benign. There's a lot of interactions. And so, depending on where you are in the country and what fungal infections you're worried about and what prophylaxis you're giving, or should they develop, you know, a mucor, for example, fungal infection, how does that impact potential chemotherapy or maintenance or other agents that they're, you know, receiving? So, I try to be pretty all-encompassing. And then again, Dr. Kuntianis, who's the senior author, and Dr. Douglas, who was the first author, were really good about just seeking general feedback throughout the guideline. So as they were working on it and everybody had their section, providing any sort of feedback or questions that we thought may be relevant to the general audience that comes up in practice. So although my focus was on the tables, we all gave feedback to the entire guideline.
Yeah, for sure. Looking at the use of antifungals, what are you guys doing for prophylaxis, like during conditioning, and when do you, or if you make a switch, when do you make it?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it, you know, obviously depends on the patient. For us, we are in a more fungal endemic belt down in Texas, or so we think. So I think we're a little bit more aggressive with our posaconazole or voriconazole, if you will. We try to avoid it during the conditioning regimen if we can, and maybe do like an echinocandin bridge. But it's not uncommon for us to have patients that are neutropenic coming into transplant. So maybe taking them off the prophylaxis they were receiving with the leukemia team is not the ideal scenario. We are a very busulfan heavy center, but we do have the luxury of doing our own pharmacokinetics, so we are able to account for that potential interaction. But in an ideal scenario, if they're coming in a clean remission, they have neutrophils, then we would start an ikitokinin on day minus one and bridge to an azole. Our preferred is posaconazole, mostly to avoid any potential interaction with letermovir if they're CMV IgG positive on day plus five, once the cyclophosphamide has finished. And obviously, there's a lot of controversy of how significant that interaction may or may not be, and are you increasing the Psi, are you decreasing the Psi? So it really just depends on what you read, and because the kinetics of cyclophosphamide are so difficult, I don't think we're going to have a great answer to that question. So that's sort of the ideal scenario. But obviously, if somebody's neutropenic, somebody has an infectious history that precludes us from taking them off their azole, then we would continue it throughout.
Okay.
Yeah. And we're a little bit different. I mean, I think our standard risk folks, we would do fluconazole starting on day zero, and we haven't traditionally held the azole through the PTCy. We've just kept it going. And then we risk stratify. So if people are persistently neutropenic coming off their last cycle of chemotherapy, then yeah, we'd probably continue the extended azole. Or if they have certain risk factors, so history of invasive mold, obviously, but then also like marijuana use and some other things that we kind of risk stratify. So we do a lot of posa as well, but those are kind of our go-to. If you're standard risk, fluke. If you have any other risk factors, we do posa.
Brianna, you want to chime in?
Sure. Yeah. This seems to be at least standard across from what I've seen from most peds institutions lately. But we traditionally will use ikinokinin, at least for allos, starting usually around transplant day plus one, day zero, and then continue that until they are recovered and able to switch over to an azole. Tends to be determined by the physician. If a patient's coming in, we do a lot of non-malignant transplants, so not patients without potentially history of periods of being neutropenic. So for our leukemics or malignant patients coming in, we might be more apt to switch to an azole quicker after transplant, but the majority of patients will be on an echinocandin and then transitioned over to an azole. More expansive either voriconazole, posaconazole, isavuconazole has been thrown around for some of our patients lately with
Carolyn.
more so in the setting of I think like QT prolongation. Some of the physicians tend to favor that, but a little bit more expanded for our allo patients in terms of coverage.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think we bridge the whole time everybody with an ikitokinin, like when they start their conditioning, and then we switch everybody over to an azole on day seven. We do some risk stratifying too, but most patients end up in the higher risk category just because we think everybody that gets PTCy is at least like a slightly increased risk. And some of our other ones include like cords or CD34 selected or like a prolonged history of neutropenia before or a prior infection. And we do probably all of the mold active azoles for those patients depending on insurance coverage. You mentioned the letermovir and voriconazole like interaction. What do you, are you guys everybody else, are you guys using them in combination or trying to avoid it?
We do if we have to. I would say from a prophylactic standpoint, someday I'll publish our data showing sort of
Same.
the significance of that interaction. But I will say I tend to empirically increase the voriconazole to 300 twice a day from 200 twice a day if I know they're going to be on it with letermovir, and then check levels maybe 1 week after initiation, but arguably that's early because it's induction, so that can take longer to see the interaction. So periodically checking the voriconazole level, which in a prophylactic setting I would think is a little bit more controversial to do the TDM, but also having somebody on vori with a level less than 0.1 seems a little silly. So making sure that they have at least a detectable level. Now, if say somebody was on posaconazole and developed Fusarium or Cetosporium, which that tends to be our breakthrough fungal infections after transplant in our center, just because they see so much posaconazole upfront. Then I think it becomes risk benefit because you need a good therapeutic level. And so in that case, sometimes we have stopped the letermovir and just continue preemptive monitoring to make sure that they get a good voriconazole level. Now, if we have somebody that's has a fungal infection and also high risk for CMV reactivation, which arguably all these patients are, then again, we may leave it on and get TDM. So I've had somebody on voriconazole 400 three times a day while receiving letermovir to get them that therapeutic level for their fungal infection. So I think it's being aware of the interaction, being aware of risk benefit, and then having that discussion about what to do for the patient.
Yeah, I think it definitely colors it definitely like where you are in the endemic risk of your population. I also need to publish it. But when we looked for the prophylactic setting, it turned like it's not a clinically significant interaction in our patients at least. Just I guess like they may not be as high risk as we categorize them in potentially, or we also don't do like routine TDM, but when we did those patients, the levels were similar to those who were not on it. So it could have just been sampling. It sort of showed that non-difference, but it's an interesting like thought at least. We do have options, but I think like financial toxicity is something that we end up managing more than like the other members of the team necessarily do. So that's just a consideration, I think. That's interesting.
I will say preliminary, we actually have different results. It does
Okay.
seem to impact the level, but clinically, it hasn't necessarily resulted to increased fungal infections.
Okay.
So I think, we need to look at our results more and I'm going to increase the N a little bit just to see. But we did see similarly when we happened to draw levels because prophylactic TDM is not routine, we did note a difference with the letermovir voriconazole.
Sure. All right. Any other things you guys want to highlight before we move on to the next question? Or are we good? Is there anything that from your guideline that you worked on that was left on the cutting room floor that you wish that you had included or that you had pushed a little bit harder to add in to the guideline update?
So I can talk to so not necessarily something that I wish was put in, but something I'm glad that didn't get put in. I guess it's kind of like a same question but twisted around a little bit. So that I mean, there's a lot of conversation around HHV6 of like copy number thresholds, right? So we have something everywhere has CMV, most places have an EBV, kind of like either an international unit per mil or a copy number per mil like threshold of treatment. And there were publications back in the late aughts, early 20 teens, with some suggestion of a treatment threshold, especially for HHV6 encephalitis. And I think that my take and what the ID, a lot of the ID physicians on the call was that this was a little bit outdated. And you look at the treatment threshold range, sometimes it would be as low as 20,000, other times it would be like 450,000. And what does that really mean in terms of risk of HHV6 encephalitis? And so there was a lot of conversation, a lot of back and forth, because that number was already out there. And there are places that already have an established threshold, whether or not that's really evidence-based, and how would we address that threshold and should that threshold exist? And this went back and forth through multiple calls of like, what do we do? How do we address this? And I think kind of where the flip side of the conversation is if you read the guideline, there's not a threshold established in there, very, very intentionally so, of being, you can look at the patient clinically, and if there's some HHV6, then you have an impetus to potentially treat based on what the patient looks like in front of you rather than a numeric kind of trigger. And I think that's really important. So we're not over-treating people. And we're appropriately de-escalating care when, if you have somebody that has, 10,000 copies of HHV6 in the blood, but you tap them and you get a good clean tap and the CSF is negative, that you're discontinuing therapy appropriately. So I think that was one thing that I was really happy about that got omitted from the guideline, quite intentionally so.
Yeah, that's a good one. We don't need weeks and weeks of foscarnet or canacyclovir anymore, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Nobody wants that.
Yeah. And also don't test as much unless you have a reason to test, like stop
Yeah.
testing.
Yeah, we used to
Yeah.
have a threshold or like a routine monitoring in place for HH26. I was looking back at like some of the old versions and revisions of our internal guidelines. Yeah, that's gone. So
Yeah.
it's kind of nice for most
Good.
patients that it's not there. Yeah.
And I would say this guideline helped reinforce our practice because we did not routinely monitor HHV6 unless we had a reason to check
Yeah.
based off the patient's clinical scenario. So I feel like it just further helps support that practice. So it's nice to have it officially in writing.
Same here.
Yeah, I remember having a threshold for treatment, but like I can't remember what the number was. I think it changed over the years that I've been doing this from like 20, 30, 50,000. And I was like, I can't, when do we do this? When do we not do this? Like they're fine. Like, why are we
Yeah.
doing this?
Yeah, and that even came up when we first presented the guidelines. I think it was 2 years ago. I don't remember now. At ASTCT, one of the audience questions gave that scenario of like kind of this increasing viral load of like, okay, how about now? Okay, how about now? Okay, how about now? And so it was interesting to see the like the panel response that was like, one is stop testing, and two is no, you still probably wouldn't treat it. And that was kind of like consensus that came over time. But I think the really valuable conversations were had on the back end, which obviously you would never know just reading the guidelines, that really thoughtfully addressed that omission.
And I think the
So.
other thing, maybe as a transplanter, when it's not your focus, is well, how does the chromosomal integration play a factor when you're looking at these numbers as well, which I know you guys touch upon in interpreting and then what to do with that. So I think there's a lot of complexity to looking at the number, not just looking at it for face value. So.
Yeah. And that was, I think, a big piece of this too, is you know, how often does that happen and what do you do? And it was really interesting going through the guideline for ours. I don't know if it was the same for the other experience where we initially had written our sections, we kind of divided and conquered and each kind of worked on our sections independently, then got a draft together. And it was this really robust, quite lovely, all-encompassing, massive review endeavor. And Dr. Carpenter and some others were like, whoa, guys. Like that is not the point of this document. And so we really pared down what our initial draft was into these targeted FAQ questions of like, let's specifically address these things, rather than doing this like massive, very detailed review. And I think it's much more readable. I think it's much more, you know, focused because of that. But part of me, there's like this inkling in the back of my head, I was like, man, we should have also published this, like, you know, good review article with like the couple hundred citations and had all of that together in the document. But I do think it's a more functional document in the current state.
Not too late.
Yeah, true. I do need to talk to Dr. Handy about that. That was his idea. It's like, we can come back and just publish the review. So.
I'm sure he would love that.
We all have this backlog of things that we need to do, right? So, anybody else have anything they want to highlight from the they made it or didn't make it?
I think from a pediatric standpoint, and I'll probably kind of go into this with a subsequent question, I think we did good. We had two questions for pediatrics, so I was happy with obviously that being included. Kind of going back and forth about what should be there, what we can make recommendations on, what we have the data to support, or just kind of what the we all know that everyone might be doing, but can't necessarily ha have the data to support it because people haven't published their experience quite yet.
Yeah, I think the peds things that you did were huge. And that's why I was joking before. It's like, really, I'm here just for the vibes because Brianna actually did all the work from the pharmacy end on the CMV guideline. And I was just there to say yes, and here's this table that I want to edit a little bit. I think there were two things that I thought of after the fact that I should have pushed harder. Like for the interactions, I should have added the rifamycin interactions for like letermovir. Like just explicitly, like I put it in the transport, but I should have just explicitly laid it out just because it's something that comes up. Like they want to treat latent TB, they want to start them on their three or 12 plus months of therapy. It's like, well, no, the term of years, like, there are only so many things that we know that like actually makes people like live bit longer after transplant, and like this is one of them. So I'd rather not mess it up if we have different ways of doing this. So I wish I'd laid that out a little bit more explicitly. And then we talked a lot about, I mean, we'll talk about this in the gray areas later, but like CMV, CMI, or cellular immunity, like these new measures. It's like we talked a lot about that internally, not necessarily in the guideline, a little bit in the guideline. But I was like, there are other measures of like immune reconstitution that I think are interesting because like it's not just T cells, there's like B cells. So like I was like, it's a little self-serving because it's my paper, right? So I was, I can't. That's why I could. I felt like I couldn't bring it up. But I thought like the B cell and the IgG recovery, it was like it could be another and an easier piece too for people to like can potentially look at. Piggybacking off that, were there any heavily debated topics or controversies or gray areas that were involved in the discussions for your fact development?
I think here is maybe we'll call a debated topic or clinical controversy is that there's just not a lot of robust data in this area of mycology and, for prophylaxis and then and treatment. And so you might notice specifically in our FAQ, there is no grading. And that was intentional because most of it's a level three evidence. And so there was a lot of discussion and debate about, is this a guideline or isn't guidance? And actually, Dr. Kuntianis and one of our infectious disease pharmacists, Nancy, did a little editorial about that and kind of being careful about what you call something, because is there enough evidence to truly make it a guideline or is this guidance in a space? And so I would say our guideline is more of guidance about what literature is available, but there is specifically the level of evidence surrounding what we are recommending is not there, and that's intentional. So I think something to consider when you're reading these FAQs where you see that included and not just based off the paucity of data in this patient population and with the fungal infections.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's something we kind of debated in terms of grading things, like how much evidence is there. I think the biggest thing for peds right now, which still growing body of evidence or very, very small body of evidence, is the use of like maribavir in pediatric patients that are don't fit the FDA approval. So less than that 35 kilos, less than 12 years of age. I know myself and Dr. Danziger both had experience using it in pediatric patients. Didn't really have it published at the time. And so what how to finesse that recommendation of it possibly being considered was just kind of something based on how well tolerated it is. I obviously put forth like could be use could be considered. But in terms of informing appropriate dosing, I think things are a little bit all over the place right now, given that we don't have the PK studies. And I think institutions that are using it are kind of using their own potential method. I know there was a publication at ID Week in 2025, kind of with a group of individuals using maribavir in pediatric patients. So as they go forward with that study, and I think with the manufacturer's study will help to inform. I'm sure will similar to letermovir as we've seen in the past. I think between 2020 and 2024, when it got the expanded PEDS FDA approval, we'll probably see a ton of retrospective institutional chart reviews on maribavir, and then hopefully see an expansion once the FDA and manufacturer recommendations come. But same like we saw with letermovir, just like kind of blowing up the conferences, blowing up the meetings with lots of retrospective reviews. I wouldn't be surprised if we start to see similarly for peds with maribavir over the next course of the next few years.
I think for our guideline, the most debated was still probably that treatment threshold. There's certainly a lot in the HHV6 space that is not does not have a ton of evidence, like good sound clinical evidence. And I think you see that in kind of the grading of recommendations for the non-encephalitis things, especially. So like HHV6 pneumonitis and some of these other end organ manifestations that are super uncommon but are reported now, I think, and are true clinical entities, which I think can be a little bit more tricky to manage. So I think that's another big gray area that's was talked about, but probably in the earlier edition of the FAQ had more robust conversation about.
Brandon, you remember all the talks that they were doing about CMV, CMI? I felt like every meeting, every time
Yes,
we had a call,
yes,
the
yes.
last half of it would devolve into them arguing about, well, this is like ready for prime time versus it's not.
Yeah.
And I was like, I barely know anything about it.
Yes. I feel like a lot of the debates that occurred with our guideline was in relation to that, and also just perspective of like, is there enough for this to warrant an update to this FAQ? Because the way that we approach the CMV guidelines was basically taking the two past guidelines. Is this one we can update? Is this something we don't need to update to kind of slim it down, similar to what you mentioned, Ryan, from like an all-encompassing review to like pertinent updates? And it was always interesting hearing the differences of opinions of whether it was worthy enough of an update for certain questions. So,
It landed at a full FAQ though.
yeah, it did.
So I mean, and now we're from one to like at least two or three like prospective studies. So I think it's probably coming as like a more definitive, like, oh, you could definitely use this as a supportive tool in your decision making for when to discontinue some off of the termavir. But I thought it like at the time it was really funny because like we're talking about one published study and then all of you have an abstract. Like
I was just going to say, I think that lends itself to you have these experts who are heavily involved in the research that's helping to shape the landscape of that infectious disease space. So they also are going about it knowing that this is ongoing, but not necessarily ready for everybody else to adopt into therapy.
right.
And so I think that always makes for interesting conversations and debates, depending on which camp you fall in or what you're discussing.
Yeah, I was just really entertained every time. It would be like, okay, we did everything that we were going to talk about, and now the next 45 minutes, this remaining, we'll go into this again, and then I'm going to turn off my camera and wait for it to end. The other thing that I thought was funny about ours was like, the concept of like CMV blips. I was like, I can't believe we called it blips in the paper. It just seems like a really funny like name that
What would you like to call
no, I don't know. We all know
it?
what we're talking about.
Yeah,
like these,
transient reactivations.
yeah, I was like non C clinically significant CMV reactivation. Like that seems like way too long too. But it was just funny that we all settled on blips, and it's nomenclature now. It's kind of funny. All right. After that funny story, is there anything else that you guys are hoping that we will see tackled in the future as related topics, or things that are going to happen, or do you want to talk about things that we know are on the docket?
I'm happy to comment on things that I know that will be published in the next, with the goal of the next calendar year. So this past year, adenovirus, PJP, and some parasitic infections were tackled and will hopefully be published this year. And then they've already started to select their topics for this upcoming year. And so vaccines will be one of them, and that will probably be the largest one tackled. And so I know we're all anxiously awaiting to see what that includes. And I think we'll actually be multiple guidelines to appropriately cover the topic. And then I also believe there's going to be another fungal topic as well with rare yeast, if I'm not mistaken. So those are topics that I know that are coming. I know each year they highlight topics they want to make sure that are covered, whether that be an update or a new topic. So interested to see what you guys would maybe like to see sooner than later of what's currently available.
I think the vaccines is like the most pressing or most eagerly anticipated one of the things that you discussed. I think just because we need to think about like what are we doing for after CAR and other cellular therapies, what are we doing with the new wave of vaccine hesitancy and to address that, and then the problems that we all have with like getting paid to revaccinate all these patients. I think there's a multitude of things that another update or a view on vaccines would be valuable for.
Yeah, definitely agree with that. And selfishly, from my perspective, because I'm moving into a more cellular therapy focused position. And so I think all of these touch on cellular therapy, but I think there's so many unknowns post CAR, and all the CAR products are different. And as we're doing, solid tumors are going to be a very different landscape than our classic, heme malignancies are. So it's definitely not one size fits all. And so I think everything that we can do to help support people in that cell therapy space, I think, is going to be super important. And specifically thinking like even TILs right now, how immune competent are people after TILs, after lymphodepleting chemotherapy? And I think it's very different than what the BCMA and CD19 CARs.
Yeah, and what about like CARs for like non-malignant indications? I think that's also another like hot topic and a growing area of interest that'll be hopefully we'll be able to address as we like look at it. Think the only other topic I'm kind of interested in is TB, just because I think we're taking, I don't know what it is. I think we're just taking more patients to transplant that 5 or 10 years ago would not necessarily have gone to transplant, just with the advent of PTCy and like dose reducing that and just how it's sort of like broadened who has a donor and who would be an acceptable candidate. I think it's something that we're at least going to have to address.
I believe that's also one of the topics they're potentially going to do this upcoming year as
Oh yeah,
well.
that's right.
If not this upcoming year, I suspect the following.
And that's another one that'll have a terrible, terrible, amazing table.
The pharmacist that gets to help with that one will be instrumental with all the drug-drug interactions.
Right. Well, thank you all again for taking the time to speak on these updates, and I hope that it has been helpful for everybody.